threats to our planet in the news, how will we cope with global climate change, and a reminder there are other perils out there as a 150-foot-wide asteroid whizzes by the Earth. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest in the first half hour, Paul Wapner, an expert in global environmental politics. He'll tell us about the human suffering extreme climate change continues to cause. Then, astrophysicist Steve Spangler of the University of Iowa. He'll tell us about an asteroid that will be whizzing by Earth tomorrow and the possibility of a big asteroid sometime hitting our planet after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You don't know how much you love someone until they're gone. It's a well-worn saying, I know, but so true. And today, this Valentine's Day, we imagine one of our greatest loves, one we all have, being gone. Or at least dramatically, perhaps even catastrophically, changed. The great love I'm referring to is not a person, it's our beloved planet. Later this hour, astrophysicist Steve Spangler of the University of Iowa will tell us about an asteroid that will be whizzing by Earth tomorrow on a near-collision course, relatively speaking. We'll ask about the danger of a future asteroid actually impacting our planet. But first, we want to talk about climate change and how people on the front lines of this global change are making sense of their experiences and the choices societies face for enduring climate hardship. My guest is Paul Wapner. He's a professor of global environmental politics in the School of International Service at American University, also the author of Living Through the End of Nature, The Future of American Environmentalism. On Tuesday night, Wapner gave a lecture at Iowa State University entitled Climate of Suffering. He joins us today from our studio in Ames. Paul Wapner, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Give us a sense of climate change we've experienced in the past few years. What would you say are the most dramatic global indicators we have witnessed up to this point?
Well, it's a great question because I think the challenge with climate change is things are happening all over the planet, and one has to sort of rise above to see the patterns that are going on. But as you mentioned, the hottest years on record have been very recently. In terms of dramatic indicators of climate change, I almost don't know where to start because there's so much evidence. This summer, some of the hottest wildfires in the United States, Colorado Springs experienced unprecedented wildfires. We've seen dramatic weather, erratic weather. Storm Sandy whipped through New Jersey and New York with a ferocity that I think no one predicted. I know personally when I looked at those pictures coming out of the storm, it reminded me of sort of places in Indonesia or other places that had experienced extreme flooding, and there was sort of a shock that this was actually New York and New Jersey. We can look at what's happening in Australia. Australia has suffered from unrelenting drought and high temperatures, and then very intense storms. And these kinds of things are, they correlate very well with the science. The science suggests that there will be more frequent and more intense storms, and there will be everything, they say, everything that's frozen is presently melting. Everything frozen on the planet is presently melting. And this is causing, you know, floods in certain areas and so forth.
Before we get to how people are coping, surviving, and how we are likely to be able to cope with this in the future, I want to address the skeptics because we have are still seeing skeptics, even though we've seen these record temperatures, massive storms, rapid melting of the polar ice caps. There are still skeptics. Here's President Obama this Tuesday in his State of the Union address with remarks aimed at skeptics.
It's true that no single event makes a trend. But the fact is, the 12 hottest years on record have all come in the last 50. Heat waves, droughts, wildfires, floods, all are now more frequent and more intense. We can choose to believe that Superstorm Sandy and the most severe drought in decades and the worst wildfires some states have ever seen were all just a freak coincidence. Or we can choose to believe in the overwhelming judgment of science and act before it's too late.
President Obama this past Tuesday in the State of the Union address. So when we talk about this, I know we have to separate this into two questions, Paul Wapner. One is to acknowledge climate change, global warming, and the other is to acknowledge or say what is the cause of this. Tell me, who are the skeptics still about, and what exactly are they skeptical about?
Well, first of all, I would say that skeptics are a decreasing breed. I think that we've seen over the past couple years people who were very skeptical, scientists who were very skeptical, have changed their tune. But there are still skeptics out there, some of them in the United States Congress. These people are a combination. I think it's unfair to sort of lump them all together. Some of the scientists, and there's I would say again, there's not very many of these left, but some scientists are raising, you know, legitimate questions about projections. What do the models suggest is going to happen, and is that correlating? Those skeptics, as I say, are sort of decreasing because what we're finding is that the models, sadly, the models have predicted climate change happening at a certain rate in terms of sea level rise, in terms of melting of the polar ice caps and so forth. And the data that has come in over the last few years has suggested that this is happening even faster than the models had predicted. Mm-hmm. So that's one piece of it. But there is a large swath of citizens who it's not that they've actually looked carefully at the science, but they just generally don't like the solutions that would have to be proposed if we take this seriously. If we do take climate change seriously, it means that we have some significant changes to make in society. And many of those must be led in terms of economic and technological innovation, must be led by the government. And I think that there's a strong anti-governmental political sensibility out there. And I think it's so strong that it often allows people sort of encourages people not to look at the science so carefully.
Mm-hmm.
Just
to back on the skeptics, is it true? I recall reading surveys, polls about this, that people believed more in climate change a few years ago and actually fewer people today than years prior believe in it.
Hmm. Well, there's been a concerted effort on the part of some aspects of the petrochemical industry and the fossil fuel industry to fund public efforts to basically, it's not to deny the science, but if you look carefully at it, it's just to sow a little bit of doubt. And a little bit of doubt it goes a long way. And the economic interests that have been behind this have been relatively successful. I think it's changing. I do want to say this, though, that there is there's a body, it's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was started in 1988 by the United Nations, and it brings together scientists from all over the world. We're talking about thousands of scientists who review the refereed literature on atmospheric climate change. And they come out with reports every few years, and they have consistently not only acknowledge that climate change is caused by human beings, but in fact they confirm that each time a new report comes out. Mm-hmm. And their work is vetted by governments before it can become public. So it's not sort of radical ideas out there. This is basically, you know, sort of mainstream science and again, a consensus that's been being drawn around the world.
Paul, I've also heard skeptics question also the terminology used and the increasing use of climate change as opposed to the term global warming. And I've heard some say, aha, you see, environmentalists have to change the term so that people will accept their vision even when there is a cold winter or a cooler summer than expected.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clear that up, the difference between those two terms? That are they interchangeable, climate change and global warming?
Mm-hmm. They're not exactly interchangeable. Climate change is the more accurate term in the sense that what we're seeing is patterns that lead to more intense weather. So, for example, you can have extreme cold spells happen, and that is actually part of climate change. And the way this happens is that if you think about it like this, if there's and I want to say this, by the way, climate change and global warming, they're distinct, but they're related. That is to say that the fundamental biophysical phenomenon is increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, a blanketing of that as part of a greenhouse gas, and so that traps more heat in the atmosphere. And there's no question that the planet's getting hotter. There is global warming going on. The effects of global warming include, though, if you have hotter temperatures, then you have more evaporation of water from the oceans and so forth, and this concentrates a lot more moisture in the atmosphere. When there is a storm, then, it's like if you can picture sort of a bathtub that has a drain in it, the water just doesn't dump everywhere. It dumps in concentrated places. So you could have incredible weather intensity, cold, wet, drought and so forth, and it could be extraordinarily concentrated. And so that's an aspect of climate change, but it's part of a broader phenomenon going on of global warming. And I hope that was clear.
Yes, it was. Back to Paul Wapner is my guest on this segment of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. He's a professor of global and environmental politics in the School of International Service at American University, visiting Iowa this week, also the author of Living Through the End of Nature, The Future of American Environmentalism. Paul, back to something you were talking about a few minutes ago, what governments can do about this and when and how there will be a political consensus reached to do something about that. Is there a tipping point that is approaching, for instance?
I don't see a tipping point anytime soon. And again, I say that sadly. I think what's happening is that we have an economic, some people would say, crisis on our hands in terms of unemployment. There's some evidence that the economy is starting to come back. And I think many people see a contradiction between environmental well-being and economic well-being. Mm-hmm. And I think that...
And you're saying there is not one?
I don't believe there is. I don't believe there is. I don't think President Obama believes there is. And there's much economic evidence that actually renewable energy industries, wind, solar, geothermal and so forth actually generate lots of jobs and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go on.
No. And just to jump in here, if I could, isn't, for instance, Germany a country, an industrial country that is profiting greatly from its environmental technology?
Absolutely. And I feel like the United States is somewhat falling behind in terms of leadership on renewable energy technologies. Not just Germany, but China now is the biggest producer of solar panels, much of it to be sent abroad. And so they're cornering that market.
So I, as an individual, and I think many listening, feel helpless. What can we do who are concerned about climate change and face this political deadlock, this political discussion at this time?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to recognize that in history we have felt that we've faced many deadlocks in the past, and things seemed, paralyzed and unmovable. I think about the civil rights movement and similar efforts. And I think that at a time of paralysis, that's exactly the time where I see an opportunity for citizens to become actually more vocal and more active and push our political leaders. And I would suggest that now, because of this conjunction between an economic downturn and an ecological crisis, that the arguments and the vocal expression among citizens should be to suggest that we actually have to address this problem for ecological reasons, but equally, if this is the concern, also for economic reasons. The best way to get out of both crises is to, I would argue, is to spawn technological innovation, and that can happen through government leadership to a certain extent and private industry.
Supposing there were a consensus politically, what are we looking at? Is it possible to stop, slow climate change, or are the politics now going to be revolving increasingly around coping with this train that's already left the station that we cannot stop?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two aspects on how to respond to climate change. The first is called mitigation, and that's the effort to simply slow down and ideally stop putting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And that's where much of the political effort is directed and so forth. And that's absolutely critical. And I don't think we can just throw in the towel on that. I mean, it's a huge challenge, but we know that there are technologies out there. I mean, the improvements on the price, for example, of solar panels is just dropping. The price of wind is just dropping as more innovations taking place. I want to point out, though, that the government for basically almost a century has subsidized the oil, coal, and gas industries and has subsidized the renewables at a much lesser degree and for much less time. And so I just think this vocal expression can push the government to support, at least initially, these other renewable industries. But you asked about the question of what can we do. So there's mitigation, and then there's something called adaptation. And adaptation is not trying to stop the problem per se. It's trying to create infrastructures that can actually adapt. The most obvious of these is things like seawalls and sort of research into drought-resistant agriculture. Even something so simple as burying electric lines so that storms come through and the whole power grid doesn't go down, those are forms of adaptation. Again, they don't solve the problem, but they create a more resilient society to bounce back. At the end of the day, though, scientists tell us that we in the North have to the North in terms of the world, need to cut back our carbon emissions by something like 80%. That's far from even the most idealistic political ideas that are out there. So I'm not particularly hopeful that we're actually going to be able to stabilize climate change, but I think it's absolutely essential that we slow down the rate of change and use what I would call state-of-the-shelf, not even state-of-the-art, technologies that presently exist that can enhance efficiency, that can enhance transition to a post-fossil fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. Less than 5 minutes to continue our discussion with Paul Wapner, an expert on global environmental politics and activism. Before we do have to say goodbye, Paul, I wanted to ask you about this. You have said that you want the American environmental movement to regroup, to refashion itself, to be more politically relevant in the 21st century. How would it do that?
There's many different ways to answer that question. I've just written a book a couple of years ago called Living Through the End of Nature, where I suggest that one of the ways the environmental movement can do this is to become less of a nature-centered movement and more of a environment-centered, and that distinction simply means not just taking the more-than-human world as if it's sort of a pristine, untouched realm and trying to protect that, because I think that, sadly, with climate change, there is no place anymore that is untouched. There is no such thing as nature in and of itself. But that doesn't mean the game's over. It means environmentalism can sort of embrace efforts to enhance justice, to enhance well-being of humans and the more than human, and to expand its efforts so that it takes seriously, it doesn't sort of diss technology and it doesn't see itself as having a kind of a ideal life somewhere in the woods, but takes very seriously where we live, how we live, and trying to bring the most health to that those domains.
Do you think we'll be able to give up some of the modern conveniences and habits that we have that are not environmentally sound? Have we been doing that?
I think some sectors of the society have been able to do that, and I think that they've been important models for the rest of society. But I don't think environmentalism is asking us to sort of go backwards. But what they're asking is, can we shed some of our addictions for something actually more attractive? I mean, it turns out for all our technologies, for all our comforts, people are not necessarily getting any happier. The evidence on this from psychologists has been they've been keeping records of people's levels of happiness. It turns out that the, for example, the members of the Fortune 500, I think it's, I won't remember the exact number, but they have about the same happiness quotient as the Amish. Mm. And so you got to ask yourselves the question, is this making us that happy? And so when you ask the question, can we cut back? I think actually it's not necessarily cutting back. It's sort of pivoting in a different direction where we get in touch more with what we really value in life rather than all the gadgets and comforts that we think are the center of life.
And finally, Paul, in the remaining moment, I was interested to see that doing any sort of activist work, including your area, environmentalism, produces a high rate of burnout. Why would that be?
Well, I think as you've been pointing out through the discussion, that these are not easy problems. These are serious civilizational challenges, and any normal human being that puts their shoulder to the grindstone and tries to make a difference has lots of meaningful effort, but is going to get knocked around quite a bit by the resistance that we see. And I think it's important, therefore, to both hold carefully in one's mind a sense of balance between trying to inch the world toward a better and more humane future and trying to sort of retain some sense of remembering of how absolutely, you know, gorgeous and awestruck this world can be to us.
Paul Wapner, I want to thank you for joining us, professor of global environmental politics in the School of International Service at American University, visiting Iowa State University this week. He is the author of Living Through the End of Nature, The Future of American Environmentalism. Thank you very much for joining us, Paul.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment when we return, astrophysicist Steve Spangler of the University of Iowa, he'll tell us about an asteroid that will be whizzing by Earth tomorrow. We'll ask him how many such asteroids are out there zipping around and about the possibility of one of the big ones hitting our planet. Let's go into this break on this Valentine's Day with a love song to our planet, courtesy of Joni Mitchell.
Don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged all the people a dollar and a half just to see them. I said, don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away that DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, believe me, the birds and the bees. Don't it always seem to go? You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a park.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on this Valentine's Day, rather darkly, we're talking about hazards to our adored Mother Earth. Tomorrow, a 150-foot-wide asteroid named 2012 DA14 will whiz by the Earth. And as we heard in the news, it will be visible to some of us here on Earth. Its flyby will come as near as 17,000 miles close to the Earth. It is the closest any object of this size has come to the Earth that researchers have observed. Joining me now to talk about this and other plummeting planetary perils to our beloved Earth, Steve Spangler, a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in, Steve.
You're welcome.
This asteroid, DA-14. If an object like this were to hit us, it's out there a ways. But inside, I understand, some of the orbits of some of our satellites.
It's coming very close for a natural astronomical object to come to the Earth. I mean, you mentioned, for instance, the 17,000 miles. That's from the surface of the Earth. It would be like about 20,000 miles from the center of the Earth. To give a point of reference, the moon is 240,000 miles away. So mm-hmm. it's like 20 versus 240,000 miles. So it's much closer. And there are – when you watch satellite TV, you're observing what are called geosynchronous satellites, the ones that stay in the same part of the sky. And those are like 26,000 miles from the center of the Earth. So it's closer than those satellites.
Would you know if it's higher, closer than the man who jumped, made the highest skydiving record?
It's way higher than that because that was still in the atmosphere. That was probably about 20 miles out. So it's 1,000 miles further away than that.
Okay, good. Let's suppose, though, just to be dark about it, what would happen if a asteroid this size, 150-foot wide asteroid, would hit the planet?
Well, we know that pretty accurately because this is kind of what we teach people in basic physics. It's the amount of kinetic energy associated with an object that large. You said about 120 to 150 feet in diameter, and it's probably a rock. It may be a rock pile, but it has the density of rocks. So people have calculated this out to be the energy of 2.4 megatons of TNT. So mm-hmm. it's kind of like a small nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. So if it happened somewhere in the middle of nowhere, there'd be no effect. If it landed in the middle of Iowa City, for instance, it'd be a very big effect.
So. Okay. We want to point out here, too, as you did before we turned on the microphones, that your specialty actually is radio astronomy and plasma physics, not asteroids. But mm-hmm. For our purposes, you know much more than we need to know about asteroids, I'm thinking.
Well, I'm interested in all aspects of astronomy. I always say that I consider astronomy anything that's in Sky and Telescope magazine. And so that certainly has had a lot of coverage with that. So those of us that teach astronomy at Iowa try and keep abreast of all aspects of the subject.
Will we be able to see this here in Iowa?
No. There's two reasons why you won't be able to. The first is that the closest approach is going to be about 1:30 tomorrow afternoon. So it'll be up during the daytime. So people in Eastern Europe, Russia, east of that, it will be up in the dark then. And so it would be possible to see it if you're on the dark side of the Earth. You'd need binoculars. The estimates are it'll be about what we call eighth magnitude. That's a object that you can't see with the naked eye. But with a standard pair of what we call 750 binoculars, which is a lot of bird watchers have, if you knew exactly where to look, you'd see it. And it would be obvious because it would be moving against the background stars.
A point of light moving against a background of stars.
That's right.
With no tail like a comet has. Why no tail?
No. Well, it's the comets have tails because they're outgassing. It's a process we call sublimation. In other words, there's a conversion of the matter, which is frozen ice, into gas. So this is outgassing all the time, and that's what essentially produces the tail. This thing's like a rock.
Do we know what it's made of?
I think we do, in the sense that when the people have looked at it, it has colors that are similar to what are called stony meteorites. And stony meteorites you can see an example of it in Iowa Hall here at the University of Iowa or in the old Capitol. They are made out of rocks, and this is a lot of – we know that meteorites, these are objects that actually come into the Earth's atmosphere and survive to the ground, are pieces off of asteroids. So we're pretty sure that it's one of these rocky asteroids or similar to a rocky so-called meteorite.
This asteroid called DA-14, 2012 DA-14, its full name.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how we name asteroids?
Well, the 2012 is when it was discovered. It was about a year ago. The 14, I imagine, was the 14th near-Earth asteroid found that year. I don't know what DA means.
Okay. Where do we suppose this asteroid or any asteroid comes from?
Well, asteroid, the ones – this is an example of what's called a near-Earth asteroid. And the asteroids are sometimes called minor planets. They're objects that are orbiting around in space around the sun just like the major planets are, but they're much smaller in size. The biggest one has a diameter of about 600 miles. That's about 20th the diameter of the Earth. And they go all the way down in size to this thing, which is, like, say, only 100 to 200 feet in diameter. But there's a region called the asteroid belt, which is it's a big swarm of asteroids between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And I'm going to show you a diagram. Of course, your listeners can't hear this, but these colored dots, this is an indication of the region of space. The sun is in the middle of the donut.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The planet Jupiter is the circle out here. Mars would be in there. And each one of those green dots is a minor planet, like this
okay,
one.
Okay, so you hold that up again. It looks like a green donut that you're holding up.
That's
with a,
right.
With a red interior,
that's
very dark,
right.
And then outside of the green donut there are speckles of red. And you're saying that the donut part is this, that's a huge space.
That's right. It's between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. Again, Mars is about 50% further from the sun than we are, further out than we are. Jupiter's four times further out. So there's a big region of space there, and there are these asteroids there, and there are thousands of them known, and they range tremendously in sizes. And some of them get their orbits disturbed, and they come into the what we call the inner solar system, close to the Earth, and they're called near-Earth asteroids. And so people are keeping an eye on those. You'd obviously like to know if they're around.
Right, right. So the question is it to monitoring? We're tracking these near-Earth asteroids, the ones that break out of the belt or that go out, the Mavericks that come out and could possibly – I understand that the method for discovering asteroids was developed by a German astronomer named Johann Carl Friedrich Gauss in the 1800s.
Gauss was a famous person. If you've heard the bell-shaped curve, that is called in scientific terminology the Gaussian, because he was the first one to show that you'd have all kinds of random things would obey that.
So, how do we detect then these asteroids and monitor their movements?
It's very simple. What you do is essentially nowadays you'd have a very sensitive camera or a telescope that had a wide field of the sky, and it would take pictures of the sky, long exposures that don't even have to be that long anymore with the sensitivity of the cameras, and you'd see, just like you described earlier, what looks like a point of light moving against the background stars. And so that's how you find those. And using these equations that Gauss derived from a number of those observations, you can figure out the orbit, which is its path in space. So nowadays we have specialized cameras, you know, telescopes and cameras for doing this. The first one was discovered in 1800, and there are a lot of them, the big ones were discovered in the 1800s, and it was just people looking through at the sky through telescopes and noticing these things move with respect to one from one night to the next.
Steve Spangler is with me. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. And we're using this opportunity to talk about asteroids as a 150-foot-wide asteroid, DA14, will whiz by the Earth tomorrow, coming as near as 17,200 miles to the Earth, which is fairly close, relatively speaking. Steve, now to the question of the doomsday scenario and how we would detect and what we would do if there were to be an asteroid of significant size on a collision course with Earth. And before I ask you about this, it's been a scenario played out in all kinds of science fiction, as I'm sure you're well aware. And here's one, a little clip from one that I remember. The original Star Trek series from the late 1960s had an episode called The Paradise Syndrome. And here's a short clip from the climax and a little bit of setup. Kirk got hit on the head early in this episode. It was adopted by a Native American-like tribe on, of course, a foreign planet. The tribe has this pyramid structure with a great significance that turns out to be an asteroid deflector set up by intelligent beings who once lived on the planet. Here's Kirk's Pocahontas, so to speak. His love interest has just died. He's sad about that. He can't mourn too long, though, because they have to get inside the structure. Let's listen in.
Captain, were you inside this structure?
Yes. What's inside is loaded with scientific equipment.
This obelisk is one huge deflector mechanism. It is imperative that we get inside immediately. Captain, we do not have much time.
I don't know how to get inside.
If we are not able to gain entry and activate the deflector mechanism within the next 50 minutes, this entire planet will be destroyed.
Okay, reinforcing our doomsday fears from the late 1960s, the original Star Trek series. So, Steve Spangler, what about an asteroid as large as the one that killed the dinosaurs? We know that happened, and we have recent evidence that that didn't. That theory is getting reinforced all the time.
Yeah, I don't remember the Star Trek episode. I watch those things fairly religiously.
I'll give you the YouTube link afterwards.
Okay, well, I think you brought up the relevant point is that this has happened in the past. It's clear that 66 million years ago there was an asteroid impact on the Earth, and it was a large one. Instead of being 150 feet in diameter, this thing was probably 6 miles in diameter. And it's clear that it impacted. It's clear that it created worldwide adverse effects, probably a nuclear winter, flash fires all over the place, raining debris and so on. And it's believed that that at least played a contributing role in the extinction of the dinosaurs. So if something like that happened nowadays, there would be huge effects on the Earth and a big perturbation or a big adverse effect on the climate. So we have an idea of how many of these so-called near-Earth asteroids are around and how big they are. And sort of you sort them out to how many real little ones, how many little ones, and then finally what you're interested in is how many of the really big ones. And there are big ones around. I'll sort of point out another picture to you. This is a near-Earth asteroid called Eros. Mm-hmm. And it's of interest.
This is sort of an oblong. It almost looks like a bone artifact.
That's right. It looks like some kind of dog treat. That's right. But this is an interesting one in that the spacecraft has actually landed on it and come back to Earth.
Landed on this.
That's right. A Japanese spacecraft landed on that object. But you see, it's from one side to the other, 33 kilometers is about 20 miles.
That's a large dog
treat. So you would not want this thing hitting the Earth. And so there, unfortunately, in the case of Eros, it's near Earth relative to the ones in the asteroid belt, but it's nowhere near close enough to hit any time in the foreseeable future. So space is very big. So what you'd like to do, and scientists are doing this, are programmed to essentially inventory all the near-Earth asteroids, find their orbits out, and then to see if there are any ones we want to take a closer look at.
Mm-hmm. So if we would detect in the future, in our efforts, an asteroid of this size or the larger one that hit to presumably send dinosaurs into extinction— let's say we would have a period of time in which we would know before it would hit. Months, years, how long?
Well, that would depend on how good the observations are. And I really can't answer that right off the bat. But let me give you an example with this case of this 2012 DA14 that they by now have a very good orbit determination on. They say that the chances of a collision are less than something like 0.3% over the next century or something like that.
It'll keep circling in the
Oh, it will. It's yeah. in an orbit very similar to that of the Earth. So it's going to come back.
I'll save my
enough.
Notes for this show.
That's right. We can have this talk again every year essentially. So in that case, you can predict things out at least decades, and if you start – the more data you can get, you can start extending it centuries in advance. So the question you're having is let's say we had one like Eros that's 20 kilometers in – that would be roughly the size of the thing that impacted and led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. We wouldn't want that to happen. So what could you do about it? And the further in advance you know, you can slightly change the orbit such that it doesn't hit us.
Just
so
like on Star Trek, you really do have to see this.
Well,
episode.
Yeah, that's right. I
they
do.
Used a,
I'll
they
have
used
to look
a laser
this up.
Beam to uh-huh. knock it off course so it would not hit the planet.
Well, there's a simpler way of doing it than that, which is just to put jetpacks on these things so that if you had rockets, you could fire these rockets and very slightly change the orbit. And if all you have to do is to change it a little bit. And on something like this, missing by 10,000 miles makes all the difference. So that's what people have in mind, is that if you knew, say, a century in advance, there's a lot of options you'd have for slightly modifying the orbits of these asteroids. Mm-hmm. So that could actually
That's a nice-sized jetpack, though.
Yeah. That's well, but remember, we did build very large rockets in the 60s with the Saturn V's, and these things aren't that large, and you don't need that much of an impulse to change the orbit.
You don't
orbit,
have gravity to deal with.
Well, you do. It's following gravity, but then you put an additional force on it, which changes the orbit a bit.
Okay. So you don't spend a lot of nights laying awake saying, what if somebody missed that asteroid that's coming right at us in their calculations?
No, I don't. I think there are a lot of other things to worry about. I think that the point is the one you really want to worry about are the large ones that could cause continental-like devastation. And those, I think there's almost no chance one of those is lurking very close. So people have to continue to complete the survey of knowing a complete inventory of these asteroids, and there's an area of research for doing that. But I might say also just I'm a believer in statistics, and people have ideas of how many of these larger asteroids there are, and the estimate is that you'll have a real, an impact like that causes the dinosaurs extinction about every 100 million years. So it's pretty improbable. I might say there's an interesting point along the for impactors that people in Iowa might be interested in, is there was a large impact here in the state of Iowa 74 million years ago in near the town of Manson up in north central Iowa.
And we can see remnants of that today?
You can't see anything because the surface of it's filled in by, you know, the soil left by glacial remains. But there have been – it's been accurately probed, and they know what the shape of it is. And there's a central peak, which is – I don't know. It's close to the town of Manson. But they've identified this thing. I think they originally found it when they started drilling wells and noticed difference in the quality of the well water.
Mm, so deep underground.
Yeah, it's underground.
There's a shallow. There's an indentation.
Yep.
Near Manson, Iowa.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right. So it's called the Manson Meteor Crater. And that would have been a very large one, too.
The Christian Science Monitor reported in an article that this asteroid that we're talking about, the DA-14, would be worth as much as $195 billion if it were to be mined. We talked a little bit about not knowing exactly what this material is, but would mining asteroids for the future be a realistic possibility?
Not in my opinion, but I haven't really read the. I'm aware of the conjectures that this would be profitable, and I've seen letters in this magazine, Sky and Telescope. So I haven't really looked into the, the economic analysis of it. I'm really dubious about that for two reasons. One is it's very expensive to put anything into space, and that's why spacecraft missions cost so much. And usually for scientific missions, it's $100 million to get things into low Earth orbit, and people are trying to get this down to maybe tens of millions. But it's very expensive to get something into space. And this object is a 100-foot, 150-foot diameter rock, and it's probably not much different than a rock. So you can go out to Utah and see rocks this big. And so I'm very skeptical that this would pay off.
Any reason we would or could? You said one landed on this asteroid, Eros. Mm-hmm. Any reason to conceivably live on an asteroid, land humans on an asteroid?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that one of the points is that gravity is pretty important for us being human beings the way we are, and these things have very, very weak gravity. The spacecraft mission that went there, and there is a U.S. Spacecraft mission that's gone by one of the brightest one in the sky called Vesta, and is on its way to what's called Ceres, which is the largest one, is scientific interest. We think that these things may tell us something about how the solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago, and the process is still going on. So there's a lot of scientific – these are fascinating objects, but I can't see that it would pay to go and mine and bring back a pile of rocks.
Less than a minute. Are there any big, pardon me, burning questions about asteroids left unanswered?
I think that some of the questions the most interesting is that what they tell us about the formation of the solar system. In other words, that how the planets came into existence. So I think they may have some clues about that. And it's believed that they're the remnants of what would have been a planet that formed in the asteroid belt. But the gravitational essentially disturbance of Jupiter kept the planet from, quote, getting its act together.
So it cooled before it could coagulate?
Well, it kept getting disrupted by the gravitational tug of Jupiter, essentially. So there may be some material out there that is formed from essentially day one in the solar system is still out there, and that'd be very interesting to get a handle on.
Well, you've been very interesting with your insights this half hour. Steve Spangler, professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa, thank you for calming our fears.
No, it's nothing to worry about.
And for coming in and explaining more about asteroids to us. Steve Spangler, thank you. Tomorrow on this program, we heard the case for why the Boy Scouts of America should change their ban on openly gay scouts or leaders last week. Tomorrow on this program, former Boy Scout and now president of Patriots for Christ, Craig Bergman of Des Moines, explains why he likes the current policy. Also tomorrow, how the human brain is divided into fear and panic, University of Iowa researchers. We leave you with this goodbye to our beloved Earth on this Valentine's Day, an instrumental version of It's the End of the World as We Know It by the Vitamin String Quartet, originally, of course, by REM. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Help today from Jason Burns, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.